On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
We've been dealing with this for 20 months. We've been screaming about our water being wrong for 20 months. We brought the science, the middle of 2015, to them. With their own state testing, we proved that there was a widespread lead problem. And then we have medical research, their own information. We've proven over and over that the water's poison, yet we're still getting served up contaminated water through destroyed pipes, and we are still being billed the highest rates for the lowest quality water, and people are still getting sick. It's unbelievable that this happens in 2016, Great Lakes State.
And that's Flint resident Melissa Mays talking about the lead-poisoned water in her city. In a moment, how lead poisoning affects communities across the country. But first, we'll talk about another national health scare, this one involving tainted medical scopes. Last year, contaminated scopes infected 7 patients and killed 3 others at Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center. 16 hospitals across the country were affected, and a new Senate investigation has found that none of those hospitals filed mandatory reports with the federal government after the infections occurred. Kaiser Health News reporter Chad Terhune has been following the story closely, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with this Senate report with the damning title, Preventable Tragedies. What new information came out of this investigation?
The U.S. Senate report really showed a number of breakdowns in the system by the manufacturers of these devices, by the Food and Drug Administration, the chief regulator, and by the hospitals. And all of those together collectively put many patients at risk, and some died from these infections from tainted scopes.
Well, speaking to the hospitals, they're required to report when a medical device injures or kills a patient. So why aren't these hospitals doing their job?
The Senate investigators surprisingly found, talking to these hospitals, many of them were confused or didn't even know they had a requirement to report these infections. And what often happens, a hospital, something happens, it's suspicious, people are getting sick, they investigate it, and either one, they can't quite pin down what happened, so maybe they feel they don't really have anything definitive to report. There's also the reputation risk. Hospitals don't always want this to become public that they had an outbreak, so sometimes there's just that pressure to keep this under wraps.
Well, let's step back and talk about what happened here locally at the Ronald Reagan Medical Center in Los Angeles. When did the infections first start showing up here?
At UCLA, it goes back to October 2014, and then it went up through January or so. They first were suspicious at some patients getting sick in December 2014. They started their investigation and eventually concluded in late January it was the scopes. They were passing bacteria from one patient to another because the tip of these scopes, and this is a gastrointestinal scope, it goes down your mouth into the digestive tract, was bacteria getting trapped at the bottom of the scope, the tip, and you just couldn't clean them. You could not get rid of that. And it was very dangerous because it was passing bacteria that were often resistant to antibiotics. And so a patient in some cases would die. 3 patients died at UCLA and died also at other hospitals. So this was a very dangerous situation.
And at this point, it wasn't reported back to the, it wasn't reported to the federal authorities.
Well, at that point, that was kind of late in the story with UCLA. So in UCLA's case, they did alert local authorities. They were in contact with federal authorities. The Senate report was kind of going back in time because really this is a story where these infections really were avoidable. Because if you go back to the manufacturer, the biggest one, Olympus Corp., many people know them as the big camera maker. They're really a huge medical device giant. They knew about the problems with this scope going back to 2012. in Europe, and particularly they had an investigation there in the Netherlands, and it was determined, yes, this scope is very difficult to clean. It was passing bacteria to patients. Patients were being infected. They knew there was a problem in 2012, never alerted U.S. authorities, and then you just had this succession of hospitals both in Europe and the U.S., in Seattle, in Pittsburgh, in Los Angeles. Each would have their own individual outbreak. The manufacturer never told them about this problem, so everybody was in isolation, couldn't connect the dots. And then also with the Food and Drug Administration, they also were on the case, like in late 2013. Again, they didn't have all the information, didn't sound the warning, so they were very criticized as well in the Senate report.
Well, as you say, just last week, that Olympus Corporation, the manufacturer of the scopes, announced it would recall and redesign the device. Does that take care of the issue, or does this kind of contamination happen with other scopes?
Yeah, the Senate report really found there were flaws in the federal government's oversight of all medical devices that continue to put patients at risk, really an unacceptable risk to patients. The recall by Olympus certainly was a good step. I think many people applauded that was a long time in coming. They'll be doing a phased recall, so all across the country, there's about 4,000 of these scopes used all over the country. They'll be bringing them in, repairing them, and then sending them back to the hospitals. That will take several months to do that, and so I think many people were glad that finally was going to happen. But it doesn't address these larger issues. There's many reusable medical devices used every day in hospitals and outpatient clinics, and patients deserve to know that they can be cleaned, that a dangerous bacteria is not going to be passed on to me. Patients also deserve to know, have you had an outbreak in the past? Are you doing testing and surveillance to make sure you don't have a problem? Because the other theme in the Senate report was, while they identified at least 25 different outbreaks and 250 patients worldwide who were sickened by these, there's many more cases and patients that we just don't know about because people weren't looking.
Well, it sounds as if it's a bit of a story of a death by a thousand cuts, or at least three cuts. And you pointed out that a major problem is federal oversight. But how does that break down? Are hospitals too close to manufacturers, and should something be done about that? Or is it an issue of hospitals having some kind of better way to report failures, a better way to save face or not be the ones to self-police? Where are the failure and the checks and balances in the federal system?
Yeah, I think the FDA has this adverse report system, but the Senate report really found that whole database is very flawed, very outmoded. It's very clunky. They had a few incredible examples of one report that went in from a Pittsburgh hospital from the manufacturer, just never, like a paper report, never got entered into the electronic database. And it's very key. If you see the FDA, look, they're getting one report here, one report there, then they start to search. You want them to be able to connect the dots and say, oh my gosh, we've got 12 hospitals that have had this same problem. So that's very key. And you just have other situations where, you know, the manufacturers are supposed to be reporting this information. And we, in many of our stories when I was at the Los Angeles Times, showed that manufacturers would be months late reporting this information. And also with the hospitals, they would sometimes drag their feet reporting this information. So again, nobody had the complete picture. Now going forward, there were some recommendations in the Senate report. There was talking about maybe putting identifying numbers on these devices and then having that in the insurance claims data. So really you just have, you know, automatic data where you could show where device was used and maybe would show these problems much faster.
Kaiser Health News and former Los Angeles Times reporter Chad Terhune, and thanks so much for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think? How can hospitals be held accountable for the tainted scopes epidemic? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can also tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Well, from one public health failure to another, the tainted water disaster unfolding in Flint has brought the issue of lead poisoning to national attention. But it turns out the problem is more widespread than just one city in Michigan. According to CDC data, there are a number of places across the country where more than half of the children test positive for lead poisoning. States with higher levels than normal include Louisiana, Alabama, West Virginia, Kentucky, Indiana, and Oklahoma. But not all counties or even states report lead levels to the federal government. Sarah Fortenson has tracked this and joins me now. She's a reporter for Vox.com, and welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi. Good to be here, Barbara.
Well, first, tell us about Houston County in Alabama, which reported the highest rate of lead poisoning in the country. I think it's, according to your data, almost 60% of children test positive for lead poisoning. How does that compare to Flint? And tell us what's going on there.
Right. So a number of the places actually have higher rates of lead poisoning than what is being currently reported in Flint, where officials say the numbers hover around 4%. But we're not talking about these areas as much, as most of the lead poisoning and contamination isn't through water streams, but soil contamination. So when we look at Houston County, Alabama, it's, you know, rather unremarkable, a normal county, 100,000 residents. Median household income there is $40,000, which is only slightly below average for the state. So you don't see a socioeconomic reason necessarily for lead contamination. And in terms of why Houston County in comparison to other parts of Alabama, the data really just shows the number of children tested, and of those children tested, which were confirmed for having more than 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood.
And put that into lay terms for us. How does that, what's safe?
Sure. So what's safe has really changed starting in the 1970s when this really first became an issue. Initially, officials thought 30 micrograms of lead per deciliter was safe, and then it dropped to 25, 15, and 10 is still thought of as an alarming level and immediate action is needed. But 5, officials and scientists aren't sure that that is even a safe level, as very low levels of lead in the bloodstream has been linked to neurological damage, ADHD, and lower IQs. And the EPA has actually said that there's not a current threshold or safe level. So that's been an interesting development.
So that's Houston County, but does that mean that there could be counties where it's even worse that haven't reported those levels? And is it mandatory on the part of counties or states to report those lead levels to the Center for Disease Control?
So it is not mandatory, and 21 states do not submit, or 10 of them have submitted in the past but just haven't submitted 2014 data. North Carolina hasn't submitted since 2009. This does not mean that those states are not managing programs, either at the county level or perhaps city level. At the state level, but they are not reporting it to the federal government. The CDC does not mandate that or require that. So from a national perspective, it makes it incredibly challenging to try to monitor what an epidemic would look like, what areas we should be focused on. The data just doesn't exist. For half of the U.S. counties, we don't have data at the national level.
And you said this is soil contamination primarily, but you don't, given the bad reporting, how would you know where the lead's coming from in other parts of the country?
That's exactly right. So the issue, I can generally speak to the sense that it would be related to soil contamination because that's most cases, but you're absolutely right. The CDC is not currently tracking at the county what is causing the lead contamination and toxicity in the blood. It's only registering the cases that were confirmed. So you're right. We don't know what is causing lead contamination in most instances. We just know from studies that it's generally related to leaded gasoline in the earlier days, and now that's leached back into the soil. But it could be water sources. It could be anything. We don't really know.
And maybe this is a dumb question, but soil contamination, how does it get into us, if not through water?
Absolutely. So oftentimes with lead toxicity, we focus on children 5 and younger. So the thought is, when they're outside playing, just the proximity to the soil, dirt, that's how we absorb lead into the bloodstream. Additionally, there's thoughts where food is being grown. If that's being grown in an area that has high levels of lead in the soil, that could also be a contributing factor.
So where does that leave us? What are the recommendations for what should be done to better track this? And should we be just adding this to our regular blood tests, all of us, when we go in for our checkups?
Well, the crucial age is definitely if you have young children under the age of 5, because at that stage, higher levels of lead in the bloodstream can lead to serious neurological damages that cannot be reversed. So if I would look into monitoring programs at the local level, state level, see what's available in terms of resources moving forward in terms of monitoring.
What does it do to adults, a high level of lead?
For adults, I mean, similarly, there can be neurological damage. I know people in Flint have described, particularly because the lead was being contaminated through the water, itchiness of the skin. It can also, yes, it still has the same IQ repercussions, but because for younger children, you're not as developmentally mature, it has more serious effects. But it would similar like lethargic behavior for adults.
Well, thanks. Thank you for this, for laying it out for us.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Sarah Frostenson, she's a reporter for Vox.com. Well, do you think that every county should file lead test results with the federal government? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the city is going after bad landlords through the courts. City Attorney Mike Feuer tells us about the scores of lawsuits that he's filed against landlords whose properties allegedly are magnets for drugs, crime, and gangs. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Well, today, L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer announced that he's suing a mid-city motel owner, not for bilking customers or dodging taxes or anything like that. Instead, Feuer says the motel is a magnet for drugs and crime. He wants the place cleaned up, and he wants the owner to live there until it is. It's a novel legal tactic that Feuer's been using all over the city. He's filed 37 similar actions in the past year and a half. But has he gotten results? City Attorney Mike Feuer joins me now. Welcome.
Hi. Nice to be with you.
So tell us about this particular motel first, the one you announced you're suing today. You call it a flop house.
Sure. We've alleged that this motel has been a magnet for crime in the community. There have been 323 crimes and arrests at this location. This is a place which is known in the community as a location where there are drugs, where there is rampant prostitution. No one wants to have a location like this in their neighborhood. And I want to stress, it is in a neighborhood. It's in close proximity to multiple schools and daycare centers. It is the kind of location that really no one ought to have nearby their family.
And the owner, is he an absentee, or does he know what's going on and can't be bothered to deal with
it? Well, this is an owner with whom our office has had experience in the past. There have been a couple instances before my tenure as city attorney where the owner and our office have conferred about conditions on the property, but the situation is simply not tenable, and we needed to take this action to get a serious change to take place there.
Well, I mentioned earlier you've used this tactic before, and so far you've gotten 56 injunctions in the past 2.5 years.
Right.
What effect have those injunctions had?
Well, you know, I have to say, your listeners need to have a good handle on exactly the kinds of properties we're talking about. And some of them are commercial properties like this. Others are apartment complexes. Others are single-family homes in neighborhoods throughout Los Angeles. And just picture what it would be like to have on your block, let's not take this example, but rather an example where guns are a big issue, for instance, in South Los Angeles. I was at one such property walking down the street after we served the owners of the property in a single-family neighborhood. I walked down the street with a police officer who covers that beat. we were looking at the fences that line the street. One fence in front of a house after another with multiple bullet holes in it. The police officer turns to me and says, you know, the dad who owns this house has instructed his children they're not allowed to sleep in beds. Why? Because beds are above windowsill level and stray bullets are a threat to their lives. In another location, there is a multiple-unit apartment building across the street from Locke High School, a prominent high school in Los Angeles. That high school has a fence adjacent to its athletic field that is instructed to repel stray bullets, bullets that emanate from locations like the apartment across the street. What family should be expected to send their child to such a location? That's why this work is so important, whether it's drugs and prostitution or human trafficking or gun violence. Each of these properties poses a tremendous threat to the safety and quality of life in neighborhoods throughout our city. And so when we come in and shut them down, change the conditions on the at the premises and so on, we transform neighborhoods, not just a house or two.
So what has happened in those houses where you've taken out these injunctions? And you've closed, I should say, you've closed six properties.
Altogether, which is not our first choice, by the way, because we'd rather not close the property. We'd rather have the conditions there altered because we have a housing shortage in our city, for example. I'd much rather have a location where an owner says, all right, I'm going to dramatically change the conditions. I'm going to light the property. I'm going to fence the property. I'm going to assure that unlawful activity doesn't happen here and so on. But sometimes owners aren't prepared to do that, and those properties pose such a threat in the community that we have to close them down. But I've had personal experience with neighbors of such locations who have said to me, please keep this up. Please don't give up. And what's fascinating is, in many instances, we have been concerned that neighbors will not want to report this activity to us for fear of retaliation. So earlier, about a year ago or so, I put on our website a link where anybody could anonymously report instances like this. These are such important problems in neighborhoods that within just a day or so, we got about 130 people reaching out to us in that very short time, which gives you some sense both of the gravity of these problems and how pervasive they are in our city, but also because of our sustained work here, members of communities that have long been neglected believe we can help them because they've seen the impact on other blocks in their communities, and that's what I want. I want people to demand more of government and as much of our office as we can offer.
Well, back in November, you also sued two South LA apartment building owners over gang activity. What was going on there, and what's come of those suits?
Well, you know, that's a great example, actually. So, and it's really a testament to the quality of our team who works on these matters. So we got a complaint, I think a couple complaints actually, regarding gun activity at one set of apartment buildings that are owned by a common owner. There are three adjacent to each other. And we went to investigate with the police department, who are very close partners with us. And indeed, there has been a history of gun violence at that location. But rather than merely focus on that location, our team decided to delve more deeply into the facts and determined that the reason that there were gun battles going on in and around that property is that a rival gang with a stronghold just a few blocks away was competing with the gang that controlled that location, and that was why the gun violence was erupting. So rather than pursue what we call an abatement action, rather than try to grapple with the conditions at one of those buildings, we pursued both simultaneously. And suddenly these civil lawsuits, these are not criminal cases, these are civil lawsuits, became the basis for stopping a gang war. And it really gives you a sense of the potential for this program that we have when you see us come in and try to intervene and quell the violence by looking at the underlying root causes of the violence and putting a stop to it. In those locations, for example, the violence has abated.
Well, that leads me to my last question, which is when you go after these property owners, are you really addressing the problem or just the symptom? You know,
well,
gang members or drug dealers find somewhere else to go?
Well, it's a great question, and we've been trying to do – it's a question I've been asking as well, and may frame it the way I've been asking it. There's no question that simply pretending to address an issue like this does a tremendous disservice to a community. We have to actually be effective in grappling with the underlying issues. And I'm confident in location after location we've been doing that. Then one asks the next question. If there are, in many of these cases, there is gang activity involved, if we're simply moving it from one location to another, that's not helpful. One thing we have found is that when there is a concentration of this activity, of gang members, drugs, guns, in a given location, that concentration in itself has a powerful and poisonous impact in the neighborhood. When people are dispersed from those locations, the impact is very beneficial. Even if a gang member goes to another neighborhood not too far away, the absence of that concentration of guns and drugs is a big deal and a very positive impact on the neighborhood. So I've done some analyses of the impact on crime around the circumference of these locations, and crime clearly decreases within close proximity to these houses, apartment buildings, and others after we've intervened. It's a little harder for us to gauge if 2 miles away, escalating crime might be a consequence of dispersing folks who were at one time at this house. We can't tell that for sure, but I am confident from anecdotal information and the statistics I've seen that this is one of the most important programs that we can offer in my office to a community that desperately deserves and needs to be safer.
Mike Feuer, it's always good to talk with you. Thanks for joining me today.
Sure.
Mike Feuer is the Los Angeles City Attorney. Well, what do you think? Are landlords to blame for crime at their properties? Tell us about it at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why is it so hard to get Syrian refugees into the U.S.? And what happens to those Syrian families as they wait?
We're looking at the possibility of a lost generation, a generation of kids who can't really go to school, of parents who can't work, of parents who pull their kids out of school to work in order to survive. And that's really very frightening.
The plight of one Syrian family who managed to make it to America. After a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Senate Democrats blocked a bill this week that would have stopped refugees from Syria and Iraq from coming to the U.S. Yes, the bill failed, but no, a flood of Syrian refugees is not on the way. More than 4 million Syrians have fled their homes since 2011, and out of 4 million, fewer than 3,000 Syrian refugees have been able to resettle in the U.S. Politics after the terrorist attacks in Paris have made the plight of Syrian refugees even more difficult. This week in the New York Times Magazine, reporter Eliza Griswold profiles a Syrian family that managed to make it to the U.S., to a suburb of Chicago. Madeline spoke with her earlier this week.
I want you to start at the beginning where you start your article talking about and describing this Syrian family who actually made it to the United States, one of the few refugees from Syria who has done so. And they're living in Aurora, Illinois. It's near Chicago. The whole family is not together. Could you tell us a bit about them and how they got to the United States?
So the Al-Hajali family had to leave Syria, like so many people, because they were afraid of the Assad regime. That is the principal reason that people are leaving Syria, that more than 4.5 million refugees are on the move. 7 out of 10 of them are fleeing Assad's forces. They're not fleeing ISIS. So this family had a high-ranking member in Assad's military who defected early on because he did not want to be any part of the violence. And within 24 hours, all of his cousins, all of his sisters, brothers, nieces, and nephews had to leave the country or they would have been killed. So the Al-Hajalis left because of this high-level defection.
So they were living in this town in Syria, which was withstanding daily bombardments, it seems. They were in the middle of the war, and then they were just going to stick it out. But then they realized with this high-ranking member of the military in their family defecting, leaving the country, they were in trouble. They were going to be assassinated?
Yes. They fled one night over the border by car, and the mom was terrified that their names would already be on a blacklist at the Jordanian border, that the Assad's forces wouldn't let them leave the country and would throw them into prison. But they had no other option. So late one night, they headed to the border post about an hour away, and they were able to cross. They got across. Their names weren't on that list yet. And they lived in Jordan for a couple of years, nearly a couple of years, where life was incredibly tough for them. Syrians aren't really allowed to work in Jordan, and it's very difficult to go to school. So without work and school, Syrian professionals are really stuck. And the expression that is often used is between a rock and a hard place.
That Iraq Syria, is in the country.
You got it. Uh-huh. You got it. It is a tough way to live. And because they cannot sustain life in these border countries, in these countries that surround Syria, in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Turkey, because it's difficult to live, that is why people are fleeing to Europe, because life is not sustainable either at home in Syria or even close by. So nobody really wants to be going to Europe. The millions that we see on the move are really being forced to do so by the lack of opportunity closer to home.
And by millions, we're talking 4 million or so.
From Syria alone, we're talking 4.5 million.
Yeah. So the title of your article is Why Is It So Difficult for Syrian Refugees to Get Into the United States? And you detail a very extensive screening process for refugees in general, but also there's an extra step for Syrian refugees. Why is there this extra step for Syrians?
That's exactly right. There's something called the Syrian Enhanced Review. And one of the most interesting pieces of reporting this was getting into the nuts and bolts of the screening process and trying to make sense on a page of what bureaucratic talk sounds like, right? Like what actually happens in these screenings? And what actually happens is that Syrian refugees, like millions of others, go through round after round of interview, interagency vetting, which means that the FBI, the Department of Defense, vet Syrians so extensively that people told me about questions they were asked about whether or not they served cups of coffee or tea to other family members. I mean, we are talking about a high, high level of specificity.
What is that supposed to elicit in terms of information?
So because of this high-ranking member of the al-Hajli family who defected, he could be a black mark. Even though he defected, even though he left the Assad regime very early on, he could, in resettlement terms, be a black mark on this family's record. And a lot of the cousins told me that they were asked again and again, you know, did you serve him coffee or tea? What that is that's a question used to determine whether or not they provided material support to a possible enemy of the United States, like giving somebody a glass of water, giving them a ride to the post office, giving them a cup of coffee or tea. That is material support to terrorism. So it led the real mystery of this piece, the real mystery of their lives, is why is their son Wasim stuck in Jordan? And so a lot of what I was doing in reporting this is trying to puzzle out the various scenarios that could leave Wasim stuck, unable to come to the United States, even though, you know, he was assigned a flight. He had his flight numbers. He had his tickets. He had done everything, he and his two toddlers and his wife. So it's part of the mystery is, well, is there some mistake made where this uncle of his is some problem for him, that he's still a black mark on the record by mistake? The reason that this is important, the reason that Wasim's ability to come to the United States is so important, is that he's facing a choice that millions of others in Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon are facing. Whereas if by spring he hasn't heard from the U.S., he's going to and smuggling season begins, he's going to take those two toddlers and his wife, none of whom can swim, over the ocean to try to get to Europe. So every day, this is life or death for them, quite frankly.
Yeah. Were you ever able to figure it out, what it is that's holding him back from being admitted to the United States?
I wasn't. He put the New York Times in a position where we were able to sign up. I was able to sign up for, you know, to receive full information about his case, like legally a representative, you know. Even so, I just got form responses back. And I'm hoping that with the piece's publication and the clarity of what the situation is, either we'll find out why he's not able to come, or we will get a green light for him to be able to come.
Well, meanwhile, here in the United States, the rest of his family, or some of the rest of his family, his parents, his sister, and his twin brothers are here, and they're, as I said earlier, in Aurora. But they had counted on him, Wasim, to be the breadwinner, right? So how are they doing financially?
That's exactly right. They had counted on Wasim to be the one who worked in the family, and because he didn't come with them, his 19-year-old sister had to go to work at a factory, and his father, who had actually retired and has health problems, had to go work in that same factory alongside her. They are not doing well by any stretch. They are scraping by to pay the rent. You know, refugees have to pay back the federal government for loans for their plane tickets, which is something very few people, you know, have really looked into. So they have to pay that monthly bill for their own tickets to the United States. And as a result, really, of Wasim's not coming, the family has chosen that this 19-year-old daughter is going to have to get married because they don't want her working in a factory. It's not safe. And so she's going to be marrying an Iraqi who lives in the community. So as we would say, the pass-on impact of this impasse with immigration is such that it is changing the family's lives every day.
So they are five of the 2,647 Syrian refugees who have been resettled here in the United States. That is a really small number, and President Obama wanted to increase that number. I think he said 10,000 to 10,000 Syrian refugees. What's happening with that?
The president has not backed down, and I think he really needs to be commended on that. Since Paris, he has not backed down on his commitment to bring at least 10,000 more Syrian refugees to the country by October. That's the end of the fiscal year. So, and the White House is working really hard. You know, his chief of staff, McDonough, is working really hard within the administration to shore up the kind of political support necessary for this. What we saw before the end of the year was that the Paris attacks threatened to really create a bipartisan bloc for Syrian refugees and Iraqis coming to the United States. At the close of the legislative session, we saw that Democrats and Republicans alike were going to make the ban, really, what would essentially become a ban on Syrian refugees, they were going to make that part of the end of the year funding omnibus bill. They didn't succeed in doing that. So it looks like that's not going to go forward at this point.
But Paris has changed everything. And it's changed not only here in this country, but also in Europe. And you can see restrictions now being enacted throughout Europe. Even Germany is cracking down. So what does this mean for these millions and millions of refugees?
What this means, what the impact of the Paris attacks mean to these millions and millions of refugees is that they're much more likely to be stuck in the countries surrounding Syria. And that means we're looking at the possibility of a lost generation, a generation of kids who can't really go to school, of parents who can't work, of parents who pull their kids out of school to work in order to survive. And that's really very frightening. What I think gets lost a lot in this conversation is that this migration crisis isn't just a crisis in migration. It's a war. And until there's a political solution in Syria, the refugee crisis will not be solved.
Eliza Griswold, her story about Syrian refugees is in the New York Times Magazine this week. Eliza, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Looking ahead to the point, Warren Almy is here to tell us what you'll be talking about.
Hi, Take Barbara. How are you?
Great. Nice to see you, Warren.
Same here. We're going to be talking about Trump and Cruz, who appear, even though nobody's cast a vote yet, to be the leaders in the Republican candidate campaign for president. And that is...
That's quite a fracas going on there.
I use a colloquial term. That's freaking out the Republican establishment. They don't know who to go for. And many of them now are holding their noses and actually supporting Trump.
Oh, very fun. I want to hear that show.
That's how much they hate Cruz.
That says a lot. And that's coming up on To The Point. But just ahead on our show, In the Mood to Scream this weekend, if you are our film guy, Whitney Seibold has just the movie for you. Stick around for that on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. And we have some time to talk movies before the weekend and before the end of the show. There are three new releases coming out today. Whitney Seibold writes about film for Crave Online and is co-host of the B-Movies podcast. And it's great to talk with you again, Whitney.
Why, it's a pleasure to be here. Although I am discussing January releases, and that's never fun.
Well, no, and you look like you've been through the ringer. So
it's been a rough few days.
Well, let's get right to the first of these rough movies, Fifth Wave. It's a post-apocalyptic survival thriller based on the young adult novel by Rick Yancey. Here's a clip.
Here's how you kill off a species. First, you take out the easy ones, the weak, the exposed. Kill them as efficiently as possible. That was the first three waves. But even if you bug bomb a house, there's always a few cockroaches left. Now we are like those cockroaches. And the others picking us off. One by one.
Well, from this trailer, anyway, it sounds kind of like The Hunger Games. Is that what they're trying to be?
Well, it's yet another young adult adaptation. They're probably hoping for Hunger Games numbers. Sadly, I didn't know it was based on a young adult novel going in, so I was kind of blindsided by this very particular set of cliches and tropes that go into this particular type of movie. Three things in particular. One, the lead actress is the most special girl in the world. And
She's incredibly quick to learn new skills. Like
and her
gun wrangling.
By dint of no skills whatsoever, she is going to be the one to save the world. She is torn between two incredibly hunky guys, her high school crush and some fellow who, I kid you not, there's a scene in the movie where he takes a bath in a lake and splashes water on his rippling abs.
Okay.
And you got to hear every girl in the audience kind of sigh in sexual ecstasy. There's also a very distressing trend in a lot of these young adult novels to sort of promote military violence as the outlet for all teen angst. And this is yet another one of those movies. The Divergent movies are really bad about this. And this movie, and one of the major plot points, is drafting teenagers into this military force that is going to fight body-snatched aliens. And the film doesn't have the knowledge to point out the absurdity of a 7-year-old holding an AK-47. It just sort of sees this as this really cool thing. If you're a kid, you put a gun in your hand, you're stronger and cooler. And that's really unsavory. It feels like a recruitment video in a lot of ways.
I'm not hearing a lot of love for this movie. And you're picking up on three things that that are tropes of other movies. And I didn't even see those. I was too busy thinking this feels like it has parts of every sci-fi and disaster movie and TV show I've ever seen. You know, the huge lurking alien spaceship darkening the sky and the tidal wave destroying. This time it's the London Bridge.
It's all Roland Emmerich stuff. We've seen the tidal wave in The Day After Tomorrow. We've seen the ship in Independence Day. It's all derivative from other things.
And which can be great sometimes.
It can be great if it somehow emerges as its own thing, which The Fifth Wave most certainly does not. It becomes across as this derivative, not interesting, unhealthy teen fantasy.
Okay, I think we get it. Let's look at The Boy. It's a horror movie starring Adal and Lauren Cohan, best known as Maggie from The Walking Dead. Here's this clip.
We've had a number of potential nannies come through already. Do you think you can manage?
Of course.
I'm Malcolm.
Hi.
I'm the grocery boy. Well, grocery man.
Lead the way.
Allow me to introduce Mr. Hilscher. And this is our son, Brahms.
Well, first, I just love that we're in a world where there are grocery boys or grocery men.
Well, it takes place in England, so as far as I know, that's still a thing over there.
But it's the present day, and it's a creepy doll horror movie.
But yeah, what you didn't get to see in that sound clip is that the son, Brahms, is a doll. And this elderly couple has been looking after this doll as if it's their still living son who actually died many years ago in a fire. And Lauren Cohan has to be the nanny to this doll. And as she violates the rules that were set out for her,
Very quickly and very deliberately.
Yeah, she just abandons them. She doesn't follow them first night. She just gets drunk. As the nights progress, she begins hearing the doll sort of maybe scuffling about. There's a lot of creepy noises. And additionally, she is being stalked by a creepy ex-boyfriend. So we don't know what's really going on in her head.
Well, does it deliver on the screens? Or
heck yes, it does. And thank goodness for this movie. Every once in a while, a January will give forth with some sort of really exciting horror film. This one is very skillfully put forth. The doll is creepy as heck. And you're never really sure what's going on. It has really good – it's really good with pacing and atmosphere. It's actually genuinely scary. I got to see this at a midnight show. And at a midnight show, audiences will flock in and they're ready to dish out on the movie. They're ready to make noise and throw popcorn. They were dead silent throughout this one.
Wow.
Because it's so engaging and so enrapturing.
I did not expect you to say this. I read a review where they said that it had a setting seemingly purchased off the rack from the Spooky Old Manor House outlet.
But that's fine. I love the Spooky Old House Manor outlet. I go shopping there all the time. And, low-budget horror can pull out creeps if it's filmed well enough. This one's filmed incredibly well. And it has such a great, incredibly strange premise. Plus, it has some really interesting plot twists near the end, which I would not dare give away. About sort of the true nature of the boy and the true nature of the parents and the relationship that they've been having. And also with the creepy ex. And the lead character actually has some interesting drama going on, not just with the grocery boy, but with her ex-boyfriend.
Were there any nods here to those great creepy old doll movies and the TV shows from Rod Serling, you know, Night Gallery? And
I guess by dint of it having a creepy doll, it would kind of have to. So it's, you know, Talking Tina and Child's Play, all of those things kind of come back. I think, however, Brahms does emerge as this interesting, unique horror creation, especially when you learn his true nature by the end of the film. I think it's the sort of thing that horror fans are going to see and probably be talking about in several years' time.
Well, on a very different note, our last film, well, we've heard of it before. I don't know if there's a nod to Bad Grandpa, but now we have Dirty Grandpa, starring none other than Robert De Niro opposite Zac Efron. And here's a clip from the trailer.
This is crack.
I just smoke crack?
Yeah, but just like a lot.
I just smoke crack! In
the street like ballet. I don't even know how much I appreciate you doing this for me.
Did you just get naked?
That's the best way to sleep.
Oh, my God.
I want you to tear open my bra like it's a social security check. Now fumble around and pretend like you're trying to find your glasses.
I found them.
I can see.
Greatest gift a grandson can give his grandfather was a hot college girl who wants to have unprotected sex with him before he dies.
Yeah, most grandpas just want toffee or socks. Downtown.
Okay, it sounds like a hangover type film, right? But the first sentence of a review I read calls this one brutally unfunny. That's an inauspicious beginning.
It's really sad when you leave a comedy and you realize that you've laughed maybe once or twice. So many comedies.
That's a long time between.
So many comedies aim for just sort of affable. And I'd rather have something like Dirty Grandpa, which at least has the gumption to use the R-rated language, than something like, say, Ride Along 2, which does not.
Okay.
But they're equally unfunny.
Faint and praise, yeah.
The view of women in movies like this is always very faint. The story is Zac Efron has to deliver his dirty grandfather, who just lost his wife of 40 years, to a friend. And his goal now that he is a single man, is to get laid as quickly as possible. And hence the foul language. He thinks this is the way a single man ought to behave. Whereas Zac Efron is this very buttoned-down, straight-laced, people call him a lesbian rather frequently, and he is about to be married to a sacrificial shrew who is meant to be dumped by the end of the film because she is not a free spirit the way he ought to be. So women are shrews to be mistrusted or prizes to be won.
Why is Robert De Niro in this movie?
Robert De Niro will do anything. I think he probably saw it as a challenge. He is a very talented actor. He probably saw this dirty script. He's like, I'll give that a shot. We've seen him in films as strange as The Intern. He played fearless leader in The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. He's not above low material, and he's actually the best thing in the movie. He's the only one who knows how to deliver some of these lines with a little bit of character. Zac Efron's a very funny guy, but he's sort of reined in here. The supporting characters are all completely disposable, including this, quote, funny drug dealer played by Jason Mantzoukas, who is just swinging for the walls and missing each time.
Well, that high-low tension can be so wonderful, and that's what we love in Hangover, right? So why does this movie miss the target so often?
I think you have to know how to shock someone. Something like The Hangover starts with a place of decency and goes really low very quickly. Dirty Grandpa knows the words, but not the music.
Well, that is a very quippy place to end.
Whitney,
thanks so much for this. Whitney Seibold, he's a contributing writer to Crave Online and co-host of the B-Movies podcast. Jolie Myers, what are people talking about? Crime?
Movies.
Lead poisoning? Forget it. Movies. Great.
Not until they make a movie about it.
They made a movie, by the way, of our story, of City Attorney Mike Feuer.
Oh, really?
Making
the
landlords,
thing?
Yeah, of making landlords live in the property until they clean it up.
Wait,
with
is
Danny
this a,
DeVito.
Oh, there, so it's like a comedy.
Knew?
I was like, is it a documentary? No, nothing so serious as that. Maybe this time around. It is Los Angeles, after all. They're talking about movies, and I asked our listeners why we're so obsessed with post-apocalypse everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't have a lot to say necessarily on that question, though I still want to hear your thoughts on that. But somebody else named Jolie, I thought there was only me. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. Somebody else named Jolie commented on the Facebook post, and she was like, you know what? Post-apocalypse, sure, but why are we so obsessed with teenagers? God, who could be more boring than teenagers? And yet, all of our post-apocalyptic movies, or most of them, feature these precocious teens.
Well, there are so many answers to that question, but really just one.
Bucks, dollar signs. I was just going to say that. Yeah, the teens are the ones that are opening their wallets to go to the movies.
Their parents' wallets.
Yeah, and speaking of going to the movies, the Oscars officially changed their rules for who can be members, thus who can be voting members of the Academy.
Oh, yeah, maybe
today,
they'll pull some teenagers in there.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, we'll see.
Doubt that.
And younger.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Of course.
And I think we're done for today. I hope you guys all have a wonderful weekend and that you stick around for To The Point, which is coming up next here on KCRW. See ya.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.